Call to order the Senate Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection. Colleagues, today is May 9th, and we are convened for the purpose of public hearings and possible work session on five bills. To give people a heads up on where we are heading, we will start with House Bill 2920 first, because Representative Nolan is here and has another committee assignment that she must get to. We will then go to House Bill 3361, Rep. Wisnett, who also has a committee he needs to get back to. Then House Bill 2788, where I believe Representative Thatcher will be testifying, and she doesn't have a committee assignment from what I understand, so she's got a little more time, potentially. And then we will go to House Bill 2244, and then House Bill 3210 in the number five slot. So that being said, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2920. Patrick, would you like to tee it up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2920 comes to the House with a vote of 55-4 to authorize the Secretary of State to audit the use of fund transfers from the state to counties. The measure has no fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and there are no amendments, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nolan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate your attention. I will not take much of your time. This bill developed as we were working on a number of initiatives on transparency. And a question evolved as to whether this fairly substantial activity, which is transfer of funds, distribution of funds collected by the state, but dedicated to local services provided by counties and cities, whether there was a capacity to make sure that the provisions in statute were being followed when those monies were disseminated. I want to make it very clear that this is not in reaction to any evidence we found that there were mistakes or misdirections of those funds, but just as a precautionary move, we thought it was important that the Secretary of State, in official capacity to audit all transactions and all activities from a financial point of view for the state, should be able, with clarity, to have the authority to audit these kinds of transfers. There's some question as whether the global authority already granted to the Secretary includes this, but because it's unclear, I bring you this bill to make certain that it is clear that it's unambiguous and that we have that authority granted in the audit division of the Secretary of State. So I commend it to your consideration. It passed overwhelmingly in the House. You truly could think of this as a clarification, almost a housekeeping bill, but one that I think is important if we want the our constituents to really believe that we're watching the nickels and dimes and millions of dollars that they trust to us.
Good. Questions? Or
no, I think it's a great idea. We're trying to go the other way, too, but we're still working on that one.
Fair enough. Representative Nolan, thank you very much for your testimony. We'll let you get back to committee.
Thanks for your time.
All right. Can we bring up Ann Hennis?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Ann Hannis. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. We have not taken a position on this bill. We are a little puzzled about the need for it because we do understand that the Secretary of State already has this authority to do audits. And then I just also want to point out that counties do audits on their budgets and on revenues that are received. And so those are audits that we make available to the public, and we would certainly make them available to the Secretary of State and anybody else that would like to see them. So that's all that I need to say.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Would anyone else like to testify on House Bill 2920? Colleagues, it seems like a pretty good bill and that just goes to the point of clarification, so I'm inclined to move it. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2920 and open a work session on House Bill 2920. Senator Monroe?
Yeah, I would move House Bill 2920 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monroe has moved House Bill 2920 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Sure.
Debbie, could you please call the roll?
What are we voting on?
Aye.
2920.
Okay. Aye.
Senator Monroe.
Aye.
Vice Chair George.
Excused.
Chair Shields.
Chair votes aye. Motion passes.
Okay. Right.
Good. I think I was just going to recommend that.
I can rail on the other agency at the same time.
Senator Boquist will be the carrier on House Bill 2920, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2920 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3361. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3361 includes clustered mailboxes in the definition of related facilities for the purposes of ensuring access to persons with disabilities. It requires the Director of the Department of Consumer Business Services to incorporate clustered mailbox assembly standards in the structural code by January 1st, 2012, and requires cities and counties to adopt structural code standards for clustered mailbox assembly accessibility, rather, in local street and road standards. The measure has an emergency clause that would take effect upon signature by the governor. It has no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, no amendments to the bill, and the bill passed through the House on a vote of 59-0, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields and honorable colleagues. I am Gene Wisnant, State Representative, House District 53. I hope you all had a wonderful Mother's Day. I was in your district chair, again, with my wonderful mother-in-law in Northeast Portland.
I hope you spent lots of money
in your district.
I spent money in yours over the weekend.
Okay. We appreciate it. Taxpayers and all these people, all of the people that we need to provide services to. Mr. Chair and members, honorable colleagues, you know, this is another example of where we get to represent our constituents. Well, they come up with some great ideas. And I was contacted by Carol Fukerson, who volunteers with a lot of advocacy groups in Central Oregon. And she pointed out to me that cluster mailboxes are not readily accessible to some of our needy citizens. And so she pointed this out, and she also pointed out how one of our cities, I just spoke to Mayor George Endicott from Redmond, and she talked to him about this issue, and he corrected it on his own without the bill. But we think we need the bill to be sure that in the future that the cities do make cluster mailboxes accessible. You're going to have a lot of good testimony by very good advocacy groups that are going to come behind me, so I don't want to take any more of your valuable time. This is a good bill. As Mr. Venerman said, 59-0 in the House. I should have asked Representative Nolan how she voted, because she was excused that day. And it did pass out of, we got it through the General Government Committee on the 8-0 vote, too, in the House. So we've worked with the League of Oregon Cities, wanted to make sure that cities in Oregon have the ability to incorporate accessibility standards in their city and county codes. The bill is not retroactive. So if the cities, you know, can do it, but they don't have to do it in accordance with the bill. But you're going to hear how this will help some of our citizens have the ability and space needed to navigate around cluster mailboxes safely. Good bill should pass, and I hope this committee will move the bill forward.
All right. Questions for Representative Wisnant?
I have a question.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Wisnant, for bringing this bill forward. I don't see a definition of clustered mailbox in the bill. Is it defined somewhere else? And
I think, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici. I think
it
references other, I don't have, you're going to hear from, I think, the League may be speaking and other people, but, you know, all the new houses now that they have to, out, not in Portland, but out in the hinterland, they put in these cluster mailboxes. And it's in the city ordinance, but it just doesn't. They were putting them up or authorizing the builders to put them up, but there was no requirement that they have to be ADA certified.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you very much.
Before I move on, Representative Thatcher, I would be more than happy to close the public hearing on this right now and then have you testify if you'd like to move on to other things, and then I could reopen the hearing on your bill later. Why don't we do that? I'll close the public hearing then on House Bill 3361 temporarily and open a public hearing on House Bill 2788A so that Representative Thatcher can move on with her day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Kim Thatcher, I'm from House District 25. Let's change it to 26 there. Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. And last session, I had the very good fortune of working with several other legislators to create the landmark Oregon Transparency website. And the site's been up and running for just a little over a year. It's getting really good reviews. And in case, just a little review, you're looking at potentially, well, this is the website as it stands right now. It contains all sorts of information about state finances and just going back a little bit, the original concept for this bill was much more comprehensive than what we actually passed last session. We knew we weren't able to pass anything that cost any money, so we knew we would have to start from scratch and work our way up as time and resources became available. We had the very good fortune also of working with the Department of Administrative Services on this. They've worked with us and were able to start this website within their existing resources, and it's actually evolved and improved a lot since the beginning when it was set up. The legislation in 2009 also set up what's called the Oregon Transparency Advisory Commission, and this commission is there to oversee the management of the site. I am also happy to be on that commission and help make improvements. Now, the commission discussed some of the changes that I'm bringing forward today in House Bill 2788, and the bill does two main things. One, it adds the state treasurer's office to the site, and it adds a place for the public to find notices of meetings for state agencies. In talking to both the treasurer's office and the Department of Administrative Services, don't believe there is a significant fiscal impact for either agency. But just touching on the state treasurer piece of the bill first, the last treasurer specifically asked to be exempted from the website during the 2009 legislative session because I guess there were concerns about confidentiality. And I think those have been overcome and they have been addressed. And I also want to applaud the current treasurer has not only embraced the idea of joining the transparency website, but is actually voluntarily posting items to the site and has been for quite, well, a few months now. Notwithstanding the good work of our current treasurer regarding transparency, this bill would help ensure that future treasurers would continue to post the website because, remember, they were explicitly exempted from reporting in the original bill. Now, as for the other thing that this bill would do is deal with public meeting notices. I imagine that you have gotten several complaints from folks in your district, as I have, complaining that people can't don't know what's happening. They'll hear about something that's happening after the that's happening to them that affects them personally after the fact, and they just want to be able to hear about fee increases or changes in policy that affect them beforehand and be able to weigh in on them. It just comes down to the fact that Oregonians don't know what they don't know, and this would help them to get access to this information, putting all the state agency public meeting notices in one place. And that, I think, would help shine a big light on our government processes. And up here is an example of how that might look. This is shows you Yeah, go back. Here's a calendar. Here are some things that are happening on the calendar. You link to that entry on the calendar, and it would jump you over to more detail. That one specifically, let's see.
You can pick by agency.
Okay, yeah, there's different ways to pick it out. You can look at a calendar. You can look at by agency or board or commission on the different public notices, and then that could also interact with the calendar and give you a list of whatever meetings would be coming up for those different agencies. It's just different ways of interacting and figuring out what's going on. I should mention that this bill was adopted by the House unanimously, as was its companion. I call it a companion bill. It was House Bill 2825, which I believe has also been assigned to this committee. And it calls for adding information about tax incentives for economic development projects to the transparency website. I guess it's coming up Wednesday. I guess I'll be back then. One final note, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group puts out a national report card every year about these kinds of websites nationally, and we started out with a D. We've worked up to a B- recently, and hopefully with the passage of these two bills, we can work our way up to an A. Thank you.
All right. Good questions. Thank you, Representative Fetcher. We appreciate your testimony and appreciate you bringing these bills forward. Do we have? We do. So I think in...
Stick with this one.
Yeah. We've only got additional people to testify on this bill, so why don't we just stick with this and we'll run those through. So can we bring up John Bartholomew and Dugan Petty, please?
Got three chairs.
And Mike Savaggio. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dugan Petty. I'm the state's chief information officer. I'm also a member of the Transparency Advisory Commission. Members of the committee, we did the mock-ups that you saw for noticing. We think that we can very easily implement this bill as it's written. It would involve simply getting the treasurer's information and putting that in the site, which we would get. In addition, we were able to make some improvements on the site. We stood up a pilot several months back called data.org and .gov. It gave us the capability of adding some applications to this site, which enables us to do the meeting noticing. So we think it'll be pretty easy to do meeting noticing. We simply build a template. We'll ask agencies to fill out the information online in this very simple template, and then it'll display the meeting information by agency. You can get views by calendars, or you can aggregate all of those meetings in a view that would show you all the agency's meetings or all the state meetings. So we think it's readily doable by the time we get the bill. We look forward to adding additional transparency information onto the site.
Michael.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. I'm pleased to be able to put on record that the State Treasurer and the State Treasurer are firmly in support of 2788. As Representative Thatcher discussed, when the first incarnation of the bill came about, it was somewhat different than what was actually passed in 2009, and the State Treasury did initially have some concerns with regards to potential conflicts with public records laws, various unanswered questions, and the committee decided to simply write an exemption into the State Treasury. We did not testify on the bill in 2009. Regardless, the version that came out in 2009, as I mentioned, was somewhat pared down, and Treasurer Westland asked us to begin submitting information as normal. Treasurer Wheeler has continued that course of action, and we are currently voluntarily participating in the transparency site. We do feel that our concerns have been addressed in the construction of the site, and would be very, very pleased to be formally brought into that loop as the site moves forward.
Questions? All right. Thank you.
Sure. I'd just like to focus. Commend the Treasurer's Office and DAS and thank Representative Thatcher, because, you know, citizens are using it all the time. And the more transparent we get, actually, the better the ideas we come up with how to make improvements.
Uh-huh. Great. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for your testimony.
Thank you.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2788 and reopen a public hearing on House Bill 3361. Could we bring up Carol Fulkerson? Carol C. H. O. U. T. Thank you. And Ryan Green, please.
Good afternoon, committee members and Chair Shields.
I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to speak to you in support of House Bill 3361. My name is Carol Fulkerson. I live in Bend, and I am active on the MS Society Advocacy Committee. I'm also on the Steering Committee for Central Oregon Coalition for Access. I've spent a good bit of time doing advocacy work in Central Oregon. I am, in fact, speaking in support of the bill. I've been working hard to get to this point. The ability for all citizens to be able to get their mail and have a reasonable expectation of being able to access their mailbox is a basic right. And unfortunately, many people, people with disabilities, do not enjoy that right. They cannot get their mail. And this is not simply about access to the mailbox, but there's also a social component to this, to where neighbors frequently gather around the mailbox. They exchange news about whatever's going on in their community, their neighborhood. So there's a social aspect in addition to all of the value that that a person gains from being able to receive their medications through the mail, checks, benefit statements, anything like that. Mail is central to the lives of many. And ensuring that cluster boxes are on an accessible route serves everyone. This is not simply to address the needs of people with disabilities. It is safer for able-bodied people who go to their box. I heard of one woman, able-bodied woman, who tripped over the curb and fell and hit her head on the box because of the placement of it. It's good for parents with strollers. It just serves everyone. No one is disenfranchised when access is good. The U.S. Postal Service recognizes that there are people in the community who cannot access their cluster mailbox, and a person could apply to the post office for home delivery, and the Postal Service will not unreasonably deny that. So they are prepared to deliver it directly to the curb or to the door, depending on the person's specific disability and what their needs are. But there are many, many, many people with disabilities who are quite willing and able to go down the street to their cluster box to get their mail, to be treated just as everyone in their neighborhood, and to be able to collect their mail just like everyone else. They are not separated out from others. And it's also an increased expense. We know that the Postal Service is seriously restructuring. There's some serious cuts and financial problems there with the Postal Service. So it's more expensive for them to make unnecessary specific home deliveries when that person is quite willing and able to go down the street to get their mail at the cluster box. And we're not discouraging the use of the Postal Service specialized delivery to the home for those who truly need it and want it. We're not suggesting that they should not apply for that. It is just that for everyone else, they should be able to go to the cluster box. I contacted, because I was pretty baffled when I first heard that there were no standards requiring cluster boxes to be accessible. And I contacted the U.S. Postal the U.S. Access Board to ask about that, and I was told that it would require state or local legislation because in some of the photos there you'll see a cluster box installed on a pad, and that pad and box is the extent of the jurisdiction that the U.S. Postal Service has. They do not have jurisdiction in the property that leads up to and surrounds that box. So that is why there will be no standards coming from the Access Board requiring them to be on accessible route. I've also had some conversations with the Postal Service about this, and they recognize that they perhaps have not done as good a job as they could have, which has allowed some of them very seriously dangerous, actually, installations, both for able-bodied and people with disabilities. So the standards that we are asking to be installed or inserted into the state building code are based on already existing standards for an accessible path of travel. There are two things that we are asking for that are not currently addressed anywhere in any of the accessibility codes, and this is unique to cluster boxes. You'll see in one of your pictures there where it's a mid-block installation. we are asking that the State Building Codes Division also insert in the language the requirement for a site arrival point is the technical term, but in most cases it will be a curb ramp, so that a person with disabilities does not have to travel to the far end of the block to find a curb ramp to get back up onto the sidewalk and travel halfway down the block to get their mail. For the cluster box to be usable and significantly benefit them, they should be able to access it close to the box. We're also asking for a 72-inch turning space in front of the cluster box. Current federal minimums are 60 inches, and in a significant report to the Access Board just in recent months, they find that less than 50% of the population who use wheelchairs and power chairs can actually turn their chairs within a 60-inch radius. Most require 75 inches. We're asking for 72. The Access Board is considering, they're very early stages and it takes them a long time to make changes, but they are considering moving to a 72-inch minimum standard instead of 60-inch. So the 72-inch turning space and the site arrival point or curb ramp within 25 feet are very unique to this. And so I expect that there will be some detailed conversations with the Building Codes Division about that, because there's no basis for them to work from. There's no other examples already existing. Rural locations, where there's no sidewalk or curb ramp, would not have to install sidewalk and curb ramp. The language in the code, as it is with other ADA language, says firm, stable, and slip resistant. So very hard-packed soil would be fine in front of in a rural location. So rural neighbors would not have to put in a stretch of sidewalk that looks completely out of place in a rural area. They just need to make sure that it's firm, stable, and slip resistant, and that there is no significant lip between that and the concrete pad that's required. As older, previously installed, this would apply to new installations, from let's say January 1 of 2012, it would all new installations past that point. And then as older boxes are replaced due to wear or vandalism or accident, then those too would be required to be put on an accessible path. And that's in the language within the building code that applies to alterations. This would be considered an alteration. The costs for this would be borne by either the developer, if it's a new development, the property owners, or the homeowners association. It's going to depend on where this cluster box is. So there's no state or local or county funds involved in this. It is going to be, the cost will be borne by those who want and need the cluster box installed. And the Postal Service is moving more towards cluster boxes because of the it's cost-effective for them for delivery of mail. There's less theft and fraud involved. So for them, it's this will be the new standard for them. And I think that completes my comments. I'm very happy to address any questions or concerns that you might have.
Okay. Why don't we go through the whole panel and then we'll find out if there are any questions.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome to the committee. whoever you would like.
Chair Shields, Co-Chair George, and members of the committee. My name is Carol Chautka. I'm a resident of McMinnville, and I'm program manager for the National Multiple Sclerosis Society Oregon Chapter. I'm honored to be here today. The National MS Society Oregon Chapter supports House Bill 3361. This bill would ensure that all new clustered mailbox installations in the state have an accessible path of travel. The Oregon Chapter serves more than 7,200 individuals with MS and their families. Multiple sclerosis, or MS, is an unpredictable, often disabling disease of the central nervous system, and it interrupts the flow of information from the brain to the body. There are numerous symptoms, and one of these is reduction of mobility or loss of mobility, and as a result, many individuals with MS are using assistive equipment or durable medical equipment, such as wheelchairs, scooters, and walkers. The National MS Society addresses challenges of everyone affected by MS, and accessibility in our state is one such challenge. The problem is that there is no standard requirement for all cluster mailbox units in our state to have an accessible path of travel, including those in private development as well as those in the public right-of-way. The solution is to have written standards for all cluster mailbox units in Oregon based on the existing standards by the U.S. Access Board. I've mentioned that I live in McMinnville. I live in a neighborhood of single-family homes which have cluster mailbox units. This is a photo of the distance from the curb cut at the intersection, and that will work there, to the cluster mailbox units, and that distance is over 106 feet in length. And you'll see the cluster mailbox in this photo. The distance between the first two is 41 inches, and between the third and fourth is 42 inches. So there is no distance for turning radius in front of these units. There is no accessibility using assistive equipment. No opportunity to turn, open the lower mailbox or package doors, or to move forward except over a curb and into the street. These cluster mailbox units obviously are not conducive for individuals living with MS, disabilities, chronic conditions, or seniors who are using assistive equipment to maintain independence and quality of life. I urge you to support House Bill 3361. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Green.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Green, and I'm representing myself, along with the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America and its 389 members throughout the state with spinal cord injury or diseases such as MS. Most of our members use wheelchairs for mobility. For the record, I myself am not a veteran. I always, out of respect for our veterans, like to make that known. I'm here to speak on their behalf because I have a similar injury as a lot of our paralyzed veterans in the state. In my position for the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America, I provide technical assistance on the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Fair Housing Act, the Air Carriers Access Act, and several other disability rights laws. The clientele, the people I typically work with on a day-to-day basis, are architects and contractors, drafters, towns, townships, people with disabilities. I'm here to just urge your support and tell you that the lack of accessibility at cluster mailboxes affects several of the members I work with on a day-to-day basis throughout the state. And for myself specifically, I live in Sherwood, south of Portland, and the cluster mailbox in my neighborhood is about a football field away. The best, easiest way for me to get the mail is to go on the street, and that's typically never recommended, because if I try to take the sidewalk to get to my cluster mailbox, there's cross slopes. You know how the slope of a sidewalk slopes for drainage and whatnot, but even the slightest slope for a person that pushes a wheelchair is very difficult to negotiate, and so setting mail or anything in my lap typically ends up on the ground, so I've had to figure out other ways to do it. But I can tell you it's not easy when it's dry, and when it's as rainy as it is here, it's very difficult. For the PVA members and people with disabilities, this is about civil rights. Everyone should be able, you know, to be provided the equal opportunity for a simple task of even retrieving their mail. It's kind of a shame that 21 years after the passage of the ADA that we're still having to come before you and talk about accessibility issues such as this. With that, you've heard plenty of good testimony. I'll cut mine short and just wanted to share with you a little of my story and urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Green. All right, can we bring up Christy Svensson, Svendensen, Rick Bennett, and Bob Junda.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I go first, right? But thank you for not butchering my name real bad, Senator Shields. I can't say it, so I'm not going to tell you how to say it. Senator Shields and esteemed colleagues, I'm here to talk briefly about the independence and pride of people with disabilities and what this has to do with independence of people with disabilities. It all has to do with law and with our humanity, because we are people too. And this mailbox situation is ridiculous. And maybe I'm the first one to use that term, but this is something that everybody has done forever, and all of a sudden you can't even get to the mailbox. And that's like a nail in the coffin, so to speak, of their dignity. So it's a dignity thing too. But bottom line, what we're talking about is sensible placement of these cluster mailboxes. It's not rocket science, it's just sensibility. And we don't want people falling off the curb in the street like my neighbor almost did one day. And then I got her mail for her because she could not access her mailbox. And what it did for her was it prevented her from going out as much as she had, and it depreciates her confidentiality too, because I was picking up her mail. I didn't have any business knowing what she was getting. And so I'm going to stop talking right now because I tend to ramble when I get excited about something. But right here we've got something that is just a sensibility thing. People need their mail. And the older we get, the more we look forward to that daily mail.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And actually, for the record, could you please identify yourself? We are going to have to get that on the
record. Oh, I'm sorry. Christy Svensson with Blanche Fisher Foundation in Beaverton.
Great.
And 30 years experience being a person with a disability. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. AARP supports House Bill 3361. Clearly, being able to receive your mail is an essential part of community life. Frankly, for the most part, this seems to be such a common sense situation and so forth. I suspect that some of you don't even think about it until somebody brings it to your attention and says, you know, there are some difficulties here. We appreciate that the bill, in fact, is not retroactive, but as new development comes along or mailboxes are damaged and need to be replaced, the new statute would come into play, and we think that's a very reasonable solution to the problem. I've also, as a part of my written testimony, I've attached testimony from Linda Crossman. Linda is a member of AARP's Diversity Advisory Council. She could not be here today. She's out of town, but she asked me to include the testimony that she gave in the House. It provides a number of personal stories that I think demonstrate very well both the concerns that we're dealing with here as well as how the bill would address them. Thank you.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. We're very happy to support House Bill 3361. Oregon law has long had a public policy that we should strive to include people with disabilities in as many aspects of life as we can. As we continue to age, many more of us are going to need to be able to have access to some of the basic parts of life, and certainly receiving mail is one of them. This bill really addresses a little wrinkle that's in our federal and state disability discrimination laws, and does it very nicely and prospectively, and is a good bill that should pass.
Thank you very much.
appreciate your testimony. All right, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3361, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill, let's see, where are we, 2244. Yes, Patrick.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2244 comes to the House on a vote of 58-0. The measure modifies the definition of public record for purposes of public records retention and disclosure laws and for purposes of laws relating to archiving of public records. It applies to public records in existence on the effective date of the measure or created after the measure's effective date. It requires state agencies to adopt written policies regarding the use, access to, retention of, and ownership of public records. It requires policies to be submitted to the State Archivist for approval prior to such policies taking effect. You have in your packet a dash A4 amendment received today from the Secretary of State's office. I believe that's what they're going to speak to. The A4 amendment clarifies that public record does not include a record that has been destroyed in conformity with applicable retention period established by either the State Archivist or the State Court Administrator. Mr. Chair.
All right. Can we bring up Mary Beth Herkert and Barry Pack want to testify too? No?
Good afternoon, Chair Shields and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Beth Herkert, and I'm the Director of the Secretary of State's Archives Division. I'm here today to testify in favor of House Bill 2244, which would amend the definition of a public record currently found in ORS 192-005 and 192-410. In addition, we're requesting agencies that there would be, in addition to ORS 192, that would require state agencies to have written policies and procedures addressing the use, access, retention, and ownership of public records. We've worked closely with the Department of Justice to reconcile the language with their work on public records and government transparency and have agreed to the definition found in the current version of House Bill 2244. In addition, the newspaper publishers are also in agreement with the current definition. And we, as has been stated, we've forwarded the dash-4 amendments, which would include the state court administrator schedule as referenced in the definition, too. The current definition relating to public records first appeared in statute in 1961, and then in 1973, a very similar definition was added relating to public records access. So as we celebrate the 50th birthday of Oregon's public records law for retention and disposition and the 38th birthday of public records access, we acknowledge that they were written in a time when technology was in its infancy. In 1961, a single computer would have occupied a room almost the size of this hearing room, and required a bunch of punch cards written in a strange language called Fortran to make it run. In 1973, computers had become smaller, but the first personal computers were still 1 to 2 years away from hitting the marketplace. By 1989, the legislature had recognized that more of the public's business was being conducted on computers, so they added to the definition the term machine-readable record. What the law has always assumed is that a public record is something that is tangible and something that could be captured. As we've moved further away from conducting our business in a paper world, approximately 90% of what we create today we create electronically. We have noticed that there are two things. That the current definition of public records becomes harder to implement and more confusing as to what is actually a public record, especially as it relates to retention and disposition, and that written policies and procedures that address use, access, retention, and ownership of public records are woefully lacking in our agency. Let me begin by addressing the current definition. The current definition of a public record written for the paper-based world confuses public employees when it comes to what they need to keep to satisfy retention and disposition requirements. The current definition starts with a public record includes any writing, which immediately makes one think of paper. Many public employees do not think that their electronic records are public records because they have not been put to paper, and email is often not thought of as a public record because of its informal nature. Others think that as long as they work from home or on their home computer, they are not creating public records. Because of this confusion, agencies find themselves in court trying to defend their actions or non-actions. Public employees either labor over their decision as to whether a record fits the definition of a public record, or they just decide to keep everything, all of which are terribly inefficient. Furthermore, the decisions that they are trying to make relate to records that are tangible and easily captured. How can we apply the current definition to social media, a medium that was never intended to be captured, was created solely to hold conversations online, and on a platform where we cannot control how long something will be retained because once we post it, we no longer own it. I think the first step in making us more efficient in managing our public records is to have a definition that is clearly technologically independent and, most importantly, easier for the public employee to interpret. Now, for the second piece of House Bill 2244, we would like to add to ORS 192 a section that requires state agencies to have written policies and procedures that address use, access, retention, and ownership of public records. Many agencies lack these written policies and procedures, despite the fact that that's always been part of the advice and assistance that we give to them. This change would formalize and require agencies to comply. Without policies and procedures, agencies have no basis for their approach to managing public records. For example, in the case of email, it is misused by public employees, messages have been withheld from public records requests, or have been so difficult and costly to obtain due to an agency's uncertainty of their accessibility as a public record. Not retained because of lack of understanding of the public records law, or having all messages retained because it's just easier to do, which increases both liability and storage costs. And finally, agencies have outsourced some of their email to third-party vendors or have allowed employees to have Gmail, AOL, or Yahoo accounts and have lost custody or ownership of their public records and can no longer manage them for retention and public access because Yahoo doesn't care that a record needs to be kept 5 years. Yahoo retains the messages according to what their needs are and not the state of Oregon's requirements. If state agencies were required to have written policies and procedures, it would put them in better stead for litigation, allow them to address these issues up front before they become problematic, allow them to train their employees on proper management of public records, help to ensure public records are retained according to Oregon's rules and statutes, and finally have provisions for maintaining public records in public custody. The amendment to the definition of a public record will go a long way to clarifying what a public record is, and the addition of the requirement for written policies and procedures will help to hold agencies accountable for the management of their public records. Both the amendment to the definition and the addition of requiring written policies and procedures help to make government more transparent and more efficient. And thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Senator Brookquist.
Thank you. Got about a half dozen.
Our way.
I'm just to make sure I understand the bill. Can you confirm public body as the law is proposed and the changes now will apply to all public bodies across the state, cities, counties, special districts, everything? Is that correct?
Chair Shields, Senator Boquist, yes.
Question in regards specifically to the bill: electronic metadata. Why did, given the changes that are done on all electronic media, and given that the courts are using metadata more and more in terms of court cases, why have we decided that we're going to use a blanket exemption for metadata? Is that, did the department come to this? Did the court recommend this? Or how did we come to that conclusion?
Chair Shields, Senator Boquist, the Department of Justice recommended that for the access part of the law. It doesn't exempt it from the retention and disposition part of the law because that is very important for when it comes to retaining a public record, is the metadata is part of that retention.
Follow up. Hello. You know, specifically in that area when it comes to cases of, you know, campaigns, campaign finance, and things like that, every time a record is changed, for example, in ORSTAR, or there's an election change when you're counting ballots, or a new report comes up, presently it's electronic metadata that allows you to identify who inserted the change so you can track it backwards. So is the department's position is to close that up, and the only way you get access is a court order?
Chair Shields, Senator Boquist, I'm not sure to that answer. I would have to find that out for you.
I'd like the department to get back after the more follow-up questions, Mr. Chair.
In addition to that, I'm looking at the very back page here, and it jumps right out at me here. If I read this correctly, presently right now, and I know this is the case, there are multiple public records in the judicial department, in the court system, that are in fact public records. The changes that have been proposed here would mean that the judicial department has no public records whatsoever. Is that correct?
Chair Shields, Senator Borquist, the Judicial Department was exempted from our jurisdiction back in the, I think it was the 1989 legislative session, and they have jurisdiction over their own records, and so therefore they follow their own rules.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I'm looking at the law that it says public record will not include records of the Judicial Department and its officers and employees, and a state agency will not include the Judicial Department and its officers. And I'm a little perplexed why this would even, if they aren't covered, why it's even in this bill.
Chair Shields, Senator Borquist, because they're covered under a different part of the statute. Their records are covered under a separate statute and not under ORS 192.
I think, Mr. Chair, I'd like to check with the Legislative Council to find out why they inserted that, because obviously if the department didn't want it, why are we inserting that their records are not public records?
Patrick, did you have something you wanted to contribute?
No, not to that point. No. Covered.
Okay. Is that something that we can follow up on?
We can follow up on that.
Hey, Mr. Chair, to say the least, I mean, I would like to, are we going to hear from the judges themselves, or?
I'd be certainly happy to invite their representatives.
I'd be happy to invite the Chief Justice myself, too. This is a substantial change from existing practices. I'm exceptionally concerned in terms of campaign finance and the megadata that we're automatically exempting it out. I'm not sure why they didn't catch it in the House, Mr. Chair.
Did you want to respond to that? Or, come on up. We might have counsel have some points to discuss with us. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Shields. The committee. Thank you for listening. Thank you for inviting me up. My name is Patty Powell. I am an assistant legal counsel with the Legal Counsel Division of the State Court Administrator's Office and the Oregon Judicial Department. There really is no change in the status of public records with regard to this bill and the Oregon Judicial Department. The only language that is operative is the language that says, for the purposes of retention, the state court administrator has additional authority, which is in other parts of the Oregon Code, which says that the state court administrator sets the retention schedule for public records. The way this bill was first drafted, it included the state court administrator and the Oregon Judicial Department. The very first amendment, that was an inadvertent inclusion of this branch of government. And so the very first amendment was to take out the Oregon Judicial Department from under the authority of having a records retention schedule approved by the state archivist. In other sections of the Oregon Code, the state court administrator, in tandem with the state court, with the state archivist, is able to set those and establish the retention schedule. This does not say that there are no public records in the Oregon Judicial Department.
And going to Senator Boquist's question about campaign finance, would you be interested
no,
in commenting on that?
No, I'm not here to testify about campaign.
Mr. Chair. I'm with you on the amendment, the dash 4. I guess the only question I have on the state administrator dash 4 amendment, does that include administrative court judges?
I beg your pardon?
Administrative court judges, would they be included with the records of administrative court judges?
If they are under the authority of the Judicial Department, yes. If they are under the authority of the Department of Justice, no. There are two types.
Right. Not a good policy. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I guess I'm still, and I'd like you to get me, I understand what you're saying, but on the very last page of the bill, the word of the law, which the Chief Justice and the Appeals Courts always tell us, read the word of the law here, not what we all intend, definitively says does not include records of the Judicial Department and its officers and employees. State agency does not include the Judicial Department and its officers and employees.
Mr.
Bottom half, I grasp that one in regards to your amendment, but I'm not sure I agree with you.
Mr. Chair.
I agree with the intent. I just don't think the word says that here.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
I'm trying to figure this out as well, and so I went to the handy volume where sections, that definitions in section 7, and it says as used in 192.005 to 192.170, which is just the section dealing with archiving.
So why do we need it?
Well, I can't answer that. I'm sorry. It looks like that exception, which, by the way, also includes records of the Legislative Assembly, deals with archiving. But I had another question.
Okay. Senator Bonamici, and then I'll come back to you, Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask about the, up at the top of the bill in the definition of what a public record is, and I understand what you were saying about changing the writing, and that was leading to people believing that just if it wasn't written, it wasn't a public record. So now this new definition means any information that exists in any form capable of retention by a custodian. So is the effect of that to take anything that's from, for example, social media and say it's no longer a public record? Because a lot of people are using social media now, and so if we're communicating with our constituents via Facebook, it's no longer a public record because it's not capable of retention by a custodian? Is that correct?
Chair Shields, Senator Bonamici, no, not necessarily. And that's where it couples with the requirement for the policies and procedures, because if it wasn't capable of retention by a custodian, then the original record or the official copy of the public record would then not be posted to Facebook. If that was the only way and you couldn't capture it, you would have to find a way to capture it in order for it to...
Okay, I think I need you to explain that a little bit.
In social media, you lose custody of the record.
Correct.
Unless you enter into an agreement with the carrier of the social medium, or you figure out ways of working around that so you can capture what you're posting. For example, with the Secretary of State, anything that gets posted to Facebook already exists in the agency in another form. That's the official copy of the record. It's just a reference copy or a publication of something that already exists within the agency. So it doesn't matter if Facebook destroys it or deletes it after 90 days. We still have custody of the public record. And what this is saying is something like voicemail, where there is absolutely no way that you can, and that was exempted from public record a number of sessions back. But there are other means that if you can't retain it, if it's not capable of retention, then we need to figure out how you're going to deal with it as a public record, and that's where it couples with that whole policy and procedure part.
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, that we need to get legislative counsel in here to talk to, if we as legislators are using social media to communicate with constituents, and if this is going to require us to keep some sort of record independent of what's being kept in social media, we need to figure that out before this bill goes into effect.
In the exact same lines that Senator Bonamici is going along, is if we have metadata access, then we can know when it was taken off of the public record and put it on the social media. And so, I mean, it's the chicken and egg here. I mean, if you don't have access to one, to this side, then once it gets out into the social media side, I think there's a much broader issue. My guess is it looks like it went through the consent calendar on the far side, but...
All right, Senator George. I want to ask a really simple question.
Mm-hmm.
We've got smart people on either end here, and so dumb this down for me a little bit. I got 10 items that are currently covered by public records law. This bill passes. Are there 11 items that are not covered by public record law? Are there 9 items covered by another? Is this expand the definition of public records, or does this narrow the definition of public records? And what is the public losing access to? So I'm asking a question from the other side, which is, what does the public have access to now that if this passed, they would no longer have access to?
Chair Shields, Senator George, right now we are losing a lot of what's on social media because the current definition of a public record is for retention and disposition makes it virtually impossible to apply retention and disposition to something we don't own. And that's part of it. This, I think, it doesn't broaden it. It doesn't narrow it. I think it just clarifies it to make it technologically independent.
and it makes it so that it's clear for an employee, the people who are having to interpret the law, to know, is this done in the course of my business? Does this relate to need to be there to document, you know, administrative, fiscal, legal, or historical need? This is from the retention end of the law, which is the part of the law that I deal with. It makes it so that it's clear as to when something is a public record, when something is not a public record. If you apply this test to social media, you'd come up with yes, 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 and yes, it is a public record, but there's no way to retain it. So we need to figure out how can you retain that and capture that so we're not violating the spirit of the law. And that's where I'm coming at from is we need, if we're going to have a definition of public record, it needs to be able to cover all the technology that's been thrown at us in the last, you know, 20 years. We got away with it with email because you could still capture, it's a tangible record, you could still capture it. Social media, you're just running a chain of conversations that could probably have three or four retention periods assigned to it because it's just different topics at different times and going on. How do I apply the current definition to that technology? So it's a way of clarifying it so that we can have tests so that we know whether or not something meets the test, and if it does meet the test, then how long do we retain it?
Senator,
just one follow-up question. Is on page one of the bill, you've deleted the section that says public record does not include any writing that does not relate to the conduct of the public businesses and contained on a privately owned computer. So you've deleted that, so any of the privately owned computers anybody might have, they're now back in the collection system, right?
Chair Shields, Senator Bonamici, if it's public record, yes. It's back in.
So the answer to Senator George's question is it massively expands it to anything and everything?
Senator Bonamici, do you have a question?
Well, it seems that it still has to be related to the public business, even if it's on a private computer.
Right.
Can I ask a follow-up, Mr.
Yeah,
Chair?
And then I think we're going to move on because it sounds like we have some more work to do offline here, and we're not going to solve it.
I just want to make sure that I understand your interpretation of exists in any form capable of retention by a custodian would mean that if it's capable of retention, meaning if some steps could be taken to make a copy of it or to archive it, or then it would be capable of retention. So even if it isn't retained, it's still a public record, and somebody has to figure out how to retain it.
Chair Shields, Senator Bonamici, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Would anybody else like to testify on this bill?
I'm in computer space now.
Would anybody like to run away from this bill?
Well, I think concerns have been expressed. We do have a little bit more work to do to figure out if we can clarify some things on this bill. I'm open to having an additional public hearing on it before we have some discussion or move the bill. So,
Mr. Chair, before you gavel down, when it's rescheduled, if Patrick could get maybe somebody from Legislative Council.
Well, Dexter was the drafter of this. Maybe we'll just have him come down.
Somebody from Legislative Council to come and talk about the impact on legislators or anyone really who's using social media.
And Mr. Chair, someone from IT to come tell us about. I mean, we can't even save what we got from January and February right now. If we have to save everything now.
Jot some notes there, Patrick. All right. Thank you. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2244, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3210. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3210 establishes a task force on Oregon Heritage Vitality to study public funding of historic societies and other organizations related to Oregon's cultural heritage. The task force that's created by the measure would sunset on February 4, 2013. The measure has an emergency clause and would take effect upon passage and signature by the governor. There's no revenue impact. There was a fiscal impact statement that was issued by LFO that's included in your packet. The measure passed the House on a vote of 36-22. Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. Roger Roper and Christina McNitt, please.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, Christina McNitt, representing the Cultural Advocacy Coalition. We're a statewide trade association supporting arts, heritage, and humanities, and we're pleased to be here to support House Bill 3210A. It's a piece of legislation that's one of four recommendations developed as a result of a statewide grassroots effort to conduct a rigorous evaluation of the vitality of Oregon's cultural heritage. You might be asking yourself at this point, what is heritage? And I'll share with you just briefly, it encompasses a lot of interests, including history, archival records, museums, pioneer cemeteries, historic properties, districts, and trails, the Century Farm and Ranch Program, built structures, and covered bridges, among other items. You know, despite or maybe because of the diverse sectors that I just mentioned that all tuck underneath the heritage umbrella, Oregon's sesquicentennial birthday served less as a celebration of our state's history than a clarion call about its future. The end of the Oregon Trail Interpretive Center in Oregon City closed. The Oregon Historical Society in Portland significantly reduced its operations. The Southern Oregon Historical Society in Jackson County shuttered its operations for months. And it's hard to reconcile the fact that as Oregonians, we celebrated our 150 years of statehood, our state historic flagship, the Oregon Historical Society, was faltering. The very institution that houses 25,000 maps, 30,000 books, 12,000 linear feet of documents, 16,000 rolls of microfilm, 2.5 million photographic images. It was a wake-up call. Credit goes to the Oregon Heritage Commission, whose members stepped up to examine immediate and long-term challenges with the intent of stimulating solutions. House Bill 3210A establishes a 14-member task force on Oregon heritage vitality to review and critically evaluate and report back recommendations to this legislative body by October 2012, on several items. Reviewing state systems of public funding to the Oregon Historical Society, the county historical societies, museums, and other heritage organizations, to review both county historical fund operations and city museum operations and their respective effectiveness in promoting museums, history education, heritage tourism, historic preservation, and related economic development, to study private support of county historical and city museum fund operations to recommend opportunities to expand that private support, to evaluate existing laws and administrative rules to identify barriers to collaboration and partnership opportunities, and finally to make recommendations to encourage coordinated efforts among state, county, and city entities to improve history, education, heritage tourism, historic preservation, and economic development. Those are all points within House Bill 3210A. Task Force sunsets in February 2013. It's to be staffed through the State Parks and Recreation Department, this package is currently anticipated in that department's budget where the Heritage Commission is housed. Oregon's cultural heritage is a blessing, but also it's a responsibility of the present for the future. It's a significant factor, often unmeasured, which is a problem in the economic, educational, and cultural vitality of Oregon's communities. It's typically a public-private partnership in different communities with no single entity responsible for its conservation and development. House Bill 3210 would provide a focused, integrated, and high-level review by key influence makers. Jane Ann Up from the High Desert Museum in Bend says it best. She said, "It's easy to just focus on your survival, but we're going to have to turn our eyes outward soon to connect with each other and make sure that we're connected to our community." With that, I'll close. I'll pass the baton to Roger Roper with the Parks Department, again, where the Heritage Commission resides. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Roger Roper, Assistant Director, Oregon State Parks. And as Christina noted, we house the Oregon Heritage Commission. We've appreciated the effort of the Heritage Commission in conducting this vitality report and coming up with these recommendations. They did a lot of fine work. We support the task force that they've recommended to follow up on one of their key elements. You notice that toward the bottom of page 3 of the vitality report, the very first item there is the recommendation to create a task force to study the funding. So it's something we support. The cost for supporting this task force is minimal in our estimation. It fits within the scope of the Heritage Commission's duties already, and we think it could generate some meaningful results for all the heritage organizations around the state.
Question. It's been a while since I've been on Ways and Means, but the Oregon Historical Society, if I recall, was in the Transportation and Economic Development sub. Was that just by way of the CHAMPS package that put them there? Are they normally part of the State Parks and Recreation budget?
Mr. Chair, members, I'll take a stab at this, and Roger, you can chime in. But primarily, that was due to the CHAMPS package, and this session, there is no CHAMP 3 package, and there is, like, no standalone funding package necessarily for the Oregon Historical Society. It's not really housed in any other state agency. That doesn't mean there might not be opportunities towards the end of the session for funding to go to the Historical Society, but there is no budget bill.
Okay. I just want to clarify that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could clarify, too, that there were some efforts in previous years to try to fund the Oregon Historical Society, perhaps through the Parks OPRD's budget, but those never materialized.
Okay. All right, good. And so your preference is to send this to Ways and Means with the due pass recommendation?
Well, Mr. Chair, on the House side, there wasn't a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. I wouldn't say I have a preference. It's always a quicker route to a final bill, not going through Ways and Means, but it's up to your pleasure. There is a subsequent referral on the Senate side, and I believe we're talking something around $9,000, but it is anticipated already in the Parks budget.
Okay.
I'm sorry, do I miss the amount that you said, Christina?
$9,000.
Okay. Well, why don't I check in with the president's office and see if where their point of view is about this, if they had strong feelings about this, or whether or not we could recommend that subsequent referral be rescinded. But I do want to check in with them before I make any moves. So is there any questions for this panel, Senator Monroe?
You got 16 more votes in the House. What was the nature of the opposition?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, frankly, I think there's a philosophical concern by some members that task forces are sometimes unneeded, and maybe that they provide an overly constricted statutory construct that you really don't need to have a task force to do these types of activities. So generally, that was the kind of comment that we've heard back.
Can I follow up?
Senator Monroe.
Well, good, because I was concerned. I thought maybe those people, those 16 people, had a particularly tough high school history teacher.
Not so much.
They're doomed to repeat it.
That's right.
That was new.
Any other questions?
Just was wondering if Senator Monroe knew that there were 780 designated historic cemeteries in Oregon.
I knew there were a lot of them. I didn't have the exact number.
That could keep you busy for a number of sessions. All right. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3210, do a little more reconnaissance, and colleagues, this meeting is adjourned.